Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the December 2025 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article titled, Tide of History. The Hudson is bursting with a storied past. Now, with restoration with winds, it has a future, too. By Rebecca Taylor. For millennia before steamships busied the river's waters, Native Americans roved it in dugout canoes, spearing sturgeons known to fly into the air like birds. The Hudson River's restless ribbon cuts a 315-mile course down New York State, hightailing it across the backbone of the Appalachian Mountains, hurtling past the highlands where George Washington held back the British, before emptying into the harbor where Lady Liberty stands with lifted lamp on a pedestal of limestone mined from the river's valley. Franklin D. Roosevelt fished in it. Naturalist John Burroughs rode on it. Winslow Homer painted it. And Washington Irving thanked God he was, quote, born on the banks of the Hudson. There's no American history without the story of the Hudson, says historian Douglas Brinkley. The Hudson's journey begins about 2 million years ago, when the Laurentide ice sheet, towering up to 2 miles high, blanketed much of North America. Around 26,000 years ago, melting glaciers, advancing and retreating during the last ice age, sculpted the scenic river valley, carving hills and mountains. Its headwaters spring from the crystal-clear lake tier of the clouds, high up the side of a slope in the Adirondack Mountains, pouring white water down a plume stretch of wilderness. The water then rushes past a revolutionary battlefield in Saratoga, and later zips along the steep cliffs of the Palisades, the rocky bluffs that shadow the western bank from New York into New Jersey. English explorer Henry Hudson glided into the shad-filled waters in September 1609. Native Americans have long called the river Mahakantuck, a Mahakan and Lenape word meaning river that is never still, or river that flows two ways. For about 6,000 years, fresh water pouring from the mountains has kissed seawater flowing from the Atlantic roughly midway along its route, near modern-day Troy, New York, and the river becomes a tidal estuary, its current responding to the changing tides. Geologists also call this phenomenon a drowned river. Ocean tides flow inland upwards of 150 miles, causing river water rolling out to sea to reverse direction. So the Hudson retreats upriver with a rising tide and backtracks out with a falling one. The river's current changes about every 6 hours, back and forth, like a pendulum keeping time, clocking its up and down course through history. During the American Revolution, Washington oversaw Continental troops at Newburgh on the western shore, and John Adams called the river and its region a kind of key to the whole continent during that war because of its importance in connecting the northern and southern colonies, as well as Canada and Native American territories. Sojourner Truth hoed corn along the western bank. A dying Ulysses S. Grant composed his memoirs at a cottage overlooking the Hudson Valley, and his tomb in New York City towers over the river. Herman Melville may have been inspired by stories of great white whales rumored to make occasional visits near his boyhood home in Albany. A muse for artists, the river valley's sublime beauty lured Thomas Cole an English-born artist who first came upriver with his sketch pad in 1825, establishing himself as the pioneer in the lush, oil-painted landscapes that became the hallmark of the Hudson River School. The resulting panoramic canvases drew crowds clasping opera glasses to gape at his work up close. Centuries hence, an unnamed observer prophesied in the Art Journal in 1875, the river would be known for its associations of genius and patriotism. Irving was the first American writer to popularize the river valley in story, with his Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle, who dreamed for decades at the foot of the Catskills near the lordly Hudson. The river became a highway for trade and tourism as 19th-century steamboats tooted passengers to spy firsthand the glittering water portrayed so bewitchingly in Currier and Ives prints. Trees were torn from the riverbank to build sloops and schooners that lugged bricks and bluestone to fashion New York City's skyline. Speculators harvested ice from the river and cut clay from the banks until the shad and sturgeon populations waned, as did those of eagles and great blue Huron. The river's suffering was only beginning. For decades, starting in 1947, General Electric Company plants operating at Fort Edward and Hudson Falls dumped chemicals into the river, including more than 1 million pounds of toxic polychlorinated biphenyls, contaminants found to cause adverse health effects in humans and animals. In the 1960s, it became a symbol for pollution because it was a dying river, Brinkley says. But the Hudson is also a comeback story. Citizen groups launched lawsuits and pressed for legislation. In 1965, activists won a landmark lawsuit recognizing the right of everyday citizens to protect the environment and hindering a power company from cutting into Storm King Mountain along the riverbank. The Federal Clean Water Act of 1972 made it a crime for companies to discharge waste without a permit. From 2009 to 2015, conservation crews plucked poisons from the riverbed, dredging sediment along a 200-mile swath that makes up one of the largest federal cleanup sites in U.S. history. Challenges remain, says Ned Sullivan, president of Scenic Hudson. Many species have made dramatic recoveries from the brink of extinction, he says, noting a resurgence in bald eagles and ospreys. But more work is needed, he said. The sturgeons and black-blue herons are back in good numbers, too, and eagles, once all but gone from the valley, have taken flight once again along the returning majesty of this glorious river. And that completes the article. The title was Tide of History by Rebecca Taylor. An adjoining article to that one that I just read is Here Be Humpbacks by Mike Riggs, presenting some of the Hudson River's most intriguing fishy and mammalian residents. Number 1, the humpback whale. One sign that the Hudson's not as dirty as it used to be is the occasional appearance of humpback whales, sometimes spotted in the river as they hunt Atlantic menhaden fish. In 2016, a humpback ventured as far as the George Washington Bridge near Manhattan's northern tip. Another was spotted in 2020 near the Statue of Liberty in Upper New York Bay. Number 2, lined seahorse. Everybody knows these tiny tenants of the tideway have an unusual reproductive arrangement in which the males carry the eggs until they hatch. The seahorse's other fascinating feature is the development of a square tail that allows it to cling to stationary objects, like Hudson River Park's artificial reef system, which stretches from Pier 26 to Pier 34. Number 3. Hog Choker. A bottom feeder with two eyes on the right side of its head, this fish, a member of the sole family, dwells in the brackish waters near the coast and the freshwater of the estuary as far north as Albany. The origin of its name is uncertain. One story holds that farmers would feed them to their hogs, only to find the fish suctioned to the pigs' palates, sometimes causing piggies to gag. Number 4. The Atlantic Tom Cod. The fleshy face of the tom cod is delicious when pan-fried in butter. Just don't get your fish from the Hudson, where the local tom cod population has developed a genetic resistance to some pollutants found in the river. They might look healthy, but they're chock-full of PCBs. And lastly, number 5, the short-nosed sturgeon. Some of the short-nosed specimens that roam the Hudson today can live for as long as 60 years. Now bouncing back after two centuries of overfishing, this protected bottom feeder is in many ways just another New Yorker. It delights in spending most of its time near the city, but looks forward to venturing upstate by river when the weather turns warm. And that completes a look at some of the Hudson River's most intriguing fishy and mammalian residents. The title was Here Be Humpbacks by Mike Riggs. This article is titled Naughty or Nice? A new book from street photographer Lee Friedlander captures Christmas from all angles. It's by Amy Crawford. In America, Christmas is an expansive holiday. At different times, to different people, it may be a joyous celebration of the birth of Jesus, a time for families to gather, an overwrought occasion tainted by materialism, or all of that at once. Whether or not you celebrate, it's an unavoidable element of American culture, as photographer Lee Friedlander shows in a new book, Christmas. For more than 7 decades, and in places as diverse as Honolulu, West Texas, and upstate New York, Friedlander, 91, has documented what he calls the social landscape. Stoops, storefronts, roadways without bias. The camera, he once wrote, is a kind of net. The net is indiscriminate unless you point it, and then are lucky. I might get what I hope for, and then some, lots of then some, more than I might have remembered was there. And plenty is there in the familiar scenes of his black-and-white Yuletide photographs. Molded plastic nativities in suburban yards, corporate lobbies festooned with fiberglass decorations, and earnest children meeting Santa Claus. Like a lot of our culture, it's this amazing combination of commercialism and sentimentality, says Peter Caiaphas, Friedlander's longtime friend and publisher. It's all there, and it's all American. And that ends the article, Naughty or Nice, by Amy Crawford. The next article is Greatest Movie Ever. With his 1954 triumph, Akira Kurosawa became one of the most influential directors of all time, by John Simley. The film was long and getting longer by the day. Worse still, the director was bent on shooting outdoors on a mountainous peninsula west of Tokyo, and the rain during the interminably long production period between 1953 and 1954 was just as bent on falling in heavy sheets. Before production was anywhere close to wrapped, the budget was already 10 times that of the average Japanese film, and the ballooning expenses led to extended hiatuses in shooting as the Toho Motion Picture Company scrambled to find more money. In the national press, meanwhile, the production was already a byword for bloat and dysfunction. The director had earned the disparaging nickname Kurosawa Tenno, or Emperor Kurosawa, a nod to his authoritarian bearing and to the way his most ambitious film was expanding into its own miniature shogunate. Seemingly untroubled by these costly, unproductive, and highly publicized delays, the acclaimed Japanese director, Akira Kurosawa, would use the free time to go fishing. On one such trip, actor and frequent collaborator Minoru Shiaki asked the notoriously stubborn director if he was worried about the project completely running aground. "So long as my pictures are hits," the director responded, while dangling his line off the banks of the Tama River, "I can afford to be unreasonable." Kurosawa once famously compared Japanese cinema to green tea over rice, light and wholesome. With this new film, Seven Samurai, an extraordinary action epic, he was seeking to make heartier fare, a film he hoped would be entertaining enough to eat. Kurosawa's intransigence was rewarded. The 207-minute Seven Samurai, with its extended scenes of swordplay and grandly conceived action sequences, was as innovative as it was epic, drawing superlatives from critics, turning a generation on to Japanese cinema, and changing popular culture forever. Its story, characters, multi-camera shooting, and action choreography reoriented American movie-making for generations. For those who haven't seen the movie itself, have likely seen a version of it, whether in a straight remake, like The Magnificent Seven, 1960, or in countless homages, from the Steve Martin comedy Three Amigos to Pixar's A Bug's Life. Today, 71 years after its release, Seven Samurai still resonates. Each character seems unique, sketched in loving detail, while the filmmaking itself remains bracingly vivid. Eschewing the stiffer, sturdier theatrics of Japanese epics of the era, Kurosawa cut his action scenes using multiple cameras, giving them a heightened sense of vim and realism. Despite its faraway 16th-century setting, Seven Samurai still feels modern. In the end, despite the rain and the bad press, Kurosawa's masterpiece elevated not only the Japanese sword fight movie, but also many of the American westerns that inspired it, proving that great artistry could be found in the domain of genres often dismissed as frivolous or merely entertaining. Movies would never be the same. Born in Tokyo in 1910, Kurosawa was descended from actual samurai. The family traced its lineage back to warriors who had served an 11th-century warlord. His father, a former soldier, was proud of this bloodline. He was a stern disciplinarian, always instructing his family in what the filmmaker has called the, quote, finer points of samurai etiquette. But Kurosawa, the elder, did permit certain lighter entertainment, especially Western cinema. As a child, Akira studied traditional Japanese arts like calligraphy, as well as kendo, Japanese bamboo swordplay, at which he excelled despite his admitted lack of strength. But he also spent hours in movie theaters, taking in Japanese productions and Western imports. His older brother Hiego worked as a benshir, a narrator providing live commentary and context for Western silent movies screened for Japanese audiences. His brother's work afforded the young Kurosawa not only exposure to a great many foreign films, but also something just as important, free movie tickets. As a student in the 1920s, Kurosawa initially devoted himself to art at Kyoto's Doshisha School of Western Painting. He soon realized his talents in that field would barely rise above illustrations for magazines, on the cheap. "I would knock myself out doing this," Kurosawa had said, "but you can't make a living this way." Film, on the other hand, would pay. At the same time, his well-rounded student life was introducing him to all manners of thought and literature from Europe, particularly the plays of Shakespeare, the novels of Fyodor Dostoevsky, and the economic and historical theory of Karl Marx. All this time burying himself in Western movies, literature, and art informed Kurosawa's approach as a young filmmaker. Starting in the mid-1930s, he worked his way up from an assistant director at Toho, one of Japan's preeminent studios, then called PCI Cinema Studio. In subsequent years, his work would proudly exhibit this broad range of influences, including several Shakespeare adaptations and a film based on The Idiot by Dostoevsky. The author who, Kurosawa thought, writes most honestly about human existence. Kurosawa translated his early Japanese success into international interest with films like Drunken Angel, 1948, and Stray Dog, 1949. And by 1952, his Rashomon was voted the finest form film at the 24th Academy Awards. Kurosawa initially conceived Seven Samurai as a slick, inventive retooling of the stuffier tradition of Japanese sword fight pictures called Kanbara, which many Japanese critics compared to American westerns, simple stories filled with stock characters. But Kurosawa had more respect for Hollywood traditions than many of these critics did. He believed that just as directors like John Ford had found a way to dignify and exalt the aesthetic and emotional landscapes of the studio Western, he too could make a sword fight movie that was historically detailed and immensely entertaining. The plot of Seven Samurai will almost certainly be familiar. In the countryside of 16th century Japan, a group of villagers gets wind that a troop of bandits is preparing to attack, right when the village's barley harvest is due. With little military experience and practically no weapons at their disposal, these farmers enlist a group of warriors to come to their defense. We see the villagers recruit successive samurai, each a distinctive type. There's the wizened veteran Kanbai, played by Takashi Shimura, the severe master swordsman Kaiozu, played by Seiji Miyaguchi, and the spirited sake-glugging lout Kikuchiyo, played by Toshiro Mifune. Half Puck and half Falstaff, and not actually a real samurai at all. Once assembled, the motley squad trains the villagers in the basics of warfare. Then the bandits arrive, and the samurai lead the plucky farmers through an extended, breathlessly exciting defense of their village and of their bountiful stores of barley. It's a simple story, hence in part the near-infinite possibilities for retelling it. Film critic Sean Gilman considers Seven Samurai the universal model of the men-on-a-mission movie, and the film was formative for a revolutionary generation of American directors. George Lucas has recalled being dragged to a screening of Seven Samurai by his film school friend and fellow director, John Milius. "After that, I was completely hooked," Steven Spielberg has called Kurosawa a true visionary. Martin Scorsese, invoking the samurai traditions of apprenticeship and ascendancy, once called Kurosawa his master. Each new generation of filmmakers tries to elevate the genres they grew up on, make them artier, more sophisticated, more politically committed, Gilman says. The new Hollywood filmmakers saw that in Kurosawa, he made samurai films, but he made elevated samurai films. In the same way, they wanted to elevate westerns and gangster films. For these American young guns, Kurosawa exemplified new ways of investing noir pictures, sci-fi stories, and shark thrillers with a renewed sense of verse and seriousness. Though Kurosawa's career spanned 50 years and some 30 films, many of them masterpieces, Seven Samurai remains his most influential and most beloved. In 2022, the taste-making, canon-forming, once-a-decade poll conducted by the influential British film magazine Sight and Sound counted Seven Samurai among the 20 greatest movies of all time. And with that, we have run out of time today. That ends the article titled Greatest Movie Ever by John Semley. You've been listening to the Smithsonian Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I've been reading articles from the December 2025 issue of the Smithsonian. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and thank you so much for spending your time with me today.